Welcome to the final episode of Season 2 of Unpaused, or at least the final of the public podcasts I've recorded, but more on that later. This is where I look back over the season and extract a small gem from each interview as a way to re-emphasise what Unpaused is all about, namely helping women who've had a career break to prepare for a successful return to work that is meaningful to them. Every one of my guests in each of the two series so far has something to add to this process, whether they've had a serious pause themselves or have been in a position to help those who want to restart. I hope that what you're about to hear will inspire you to go back over the season and even listen again. I'm Judy Stewart, and you're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. Sky Ginjal's restaurant Spring has a buzz all its own. Seeing some of the magic backstage, while I interviewed her in the restaurant's garden courtyard, as the lunch setup was in full swing, was an experience I'll never forget. But going beyond the buzz, what I loved was hearing how she never tires of being in the kitchen, doing what she loves, even after 40 years on her feet at the stove. It goes to show that some people, lucky people, really are born to do what they do. But asked what brought her to this point in her career, Sky modestly invokes the Roman philosopher Seneca, reminding us that we make our own luck. Let's listen to Sky.
I knew Gail and Francesco Boglioni, and they said, "Will you come down? We've bought this nursery on the edge of the Thames, and we can have a cafe there without any restaurant license. Will you come and give us some advice about what we should do?" I parked my car and I walked along the lane, St. Peter's Lane, and I came to these two gates, and there's a field in front with cows, and it's the Thames meanders, and it's an area called Arcadia, which is a conservation area, and it is so beautiful, just like tumbling off the edge of London, off Richmond Park. And I walked in, and it was still like running as an old nursery at that point. And it was almost like someone put a television screen as I walked into the gates, and I saw it all. And I thought, this is where all my hopes and dreams can collide. It was an amazing feeling when I just felt that, for the first time, it felt like everything, all the work I'd done, kind of felt right. I remember when the first time I worked in the store with Layla, I felt like my feet were planted on the ground, and I felt in my body, and kind of all's right with the world, somehow. And I felt that when I saw Petersham, went for the first time.
You were lucky to find it, because a lot of people never find. You had a very clear idea of what that right place would look and feel like as a result of those very early experiences. Well, so then, you knew it when you found it.
I knew it when I found it. There is no such thing as luck. It's when preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that completely sums it up. And so today's work is my preparation for whatever may come ahead. You know what I mean? I'll do my best today. So all those years before Petersham, I'd cook at home the way I wanted to. I'd work with organic and farmers markets, and I'd read the books that I loved, and all in preparation. And then one day I stood outside the gates of Petersham, and it was like, where my preparation? And I saw the opportunity. And that's really what happened at Petersham. And then people responded in a kind of a really lovely way that obviously how what I love, other people liked as well.
I've been moved many times during this series, but never more so than when Mark Blazer opened his interview with me by recounting his shocking personal experience of loss amongst the devastation of 9/11. But while this experience is an important reason why he is the way he is and why he works the way he does, I wanted to understand what was at the root of his success as an investor. It's the other side of the equation, not what the creative wants, but instead what someone with a hard head and a brain for figures who's also looking to do something meaningful for himself looks for. What draws him in? And then, having been drawn in, how to make it all work.
Transformation, in the sense that I want to back people who see an opportunity to transform how something is done. And generally speaking, I want to see that in places where I can add some value and places where we see kind of societal trends moving in that direction, because you want to swim with the tide, right? So some people who might see the transformation opportunity earlier before the rest of the world catches on, those are the people I want to back. Mm-hmm. And so what I saw with food and beverage in general, right, is this idea of localism and craft and a real sense of caring about what's put in front of a customer. And, that, and I think those are trends that Noma drove in many ways, but they caught those trends, I think. And with David and with Pryor, we're seeing the same things at play. People want to connect more deeply to the places where they travel, and they are hungry to learn. And those are trends that are happening in a macro way in almost every consumer behavior. And then you think about, well, who's addressing those trends in travel? Nobody. I can see where the business can go, but it's all about execution. And it's funny, the one thing that, that David and I are both good at and also not good at, we're both really, really good at seeing the big picture and at the tiny little details that makes it special. And it's the in-between stuff that you need to build a really good team to execute, because that's not his strength and nor is it mine. So it's fun to attract an all-star group of people who can help us between the minute and the big picture.
To me, it was inevitable that Fiona Golfer's reinvention, after almost 25 years at British Vogue, would draw on the relationships she had built over a quarter of a century of being one of the most prominent noses for a story in the dog-eat-dog world of women's fashion journalism. There's no doubt in my mind that people are your most valuable resource when it comes to reviving a stalled career. You just can't do it in a vacuum. But it's one thing to pick up the phone when you're sitting behind a desk at British Vogue. It's quite another when the new editor is about to arrive and you've decided it really is time to go. At that point, asking for help from people means squaring your shoulders and seeing just how much equity you have in that Teledex of phone numbers. You have to be brave, and perhaps you have to be prepared for a few letdowns.
I remember stepping away from Vogue at a time where the political atmosphere around Vogue, it was very unpleasant. There was a sort of level of politics that I had never in my wildest dreams anticipated encountering, because even some of the young kids who stayed on, if I went and met them for lunch, I'd see them looking around nervously to make sure that they weren't seen having lunch with me. And I wasn't fired, I resigned, but a lot of my friends were made redundant. So there's a lot of very negative press about people that I liked very much, that I worked with for a long time. Mm. There was a lot of loyalty questioning. But the most interesting tiny detail of it was I was having lunch with my family one Sunday in a restaurant, and a man who I'd known for years, who owned a very important art gallery, who'd always been incredibly nice to me, came in and he said hello to the table. And finally he got to me and he just looked at me and he said, "Things must be very different for you." I couldn't quite believe it. And yet I could, because I'm not an idiot. And I thought, well, there we are. Some people will be like that with me. And some people I will be of no importance to at all anymore. And hopefully some people, hopefully, have come out liking me.
I know, but you do have that sense of self-doubt. Will they, will they pick up the phone the way they always did and all of that? And I think, in a way, is it worse for a woman? I don't know. But I think because we self-examine and over-examine things, that those encounters can be very painful.
I've worked with women for many, many years, and I've worked with really ambitious and very creative women. There's a whole emotional side to the way that women work together that I think that men don't really go to. So I think women can be very jealous, competitive, and but also unbelievably supportive and at the same time and encouraging. I had a very, very odd, close, competitive relationship with one woman I worked with who went on to be a very important editor
somewhere else and a newspaper, and I phoned her the other day and I said, okay, here I am. I've had to force these words out, but don't you think it's about time you did a story on the guinea pig? And she went, actually, I think it is, you know. And I said, it makes me sick to have to ask you, obviously. And she said, I bet it does. Hear the words. And we laughed and I said it. And the minute I'd owned that this sticks in my craw, you know, to ask you the favour, she gave me the favour. Hey.
The leap from city to country, from proper job to no job, looked like a life sentence for the ambitious young journalist Annabel Hickson. She couldn't quite find the rhythm of the Australian countrywoman, who's nothing if not famous for making something out of very little. Not at first, that is. But before long, Annabel realised that letting go of the structures that keep the world of employed work turning gave her the scope to craft a new and fruitful period of her working life on her own terms. There's still more to do, to weave the disparate threads of a career of writing, recording, photographing, and workshopping together, but she's definitely well on her way.
It was definitely a shock for me to, not so much to live, to be in the country, but to step away from a career and an office and people and deadlines. It was a wonderful place to work the paper because you were sort of assigned projects. And then I found myself in this small town and I thought, I have to work out how to assign projects to myself. I went into the local newspaper, which was just a tiny rag, and I thought, I'll get a job here. And I walked in. I basically thought they would create an office for me, you know, coming in from the Australian. And they said, oh, no, we don't have any openings. And I thought, okay, that's that. And then I tried to get a job in the cafe across the road. And they said that they also didn't have any openings. And then for the next few years, I couldn't work it out. I couldn't work out how to create opportunities for myself in this small town life. I did not know how to do it. I had babies and got a bit distracted with that, but it's only probably in the last few years that I feel confident in saying I'm comfortable working things out for myself.
Yeah.
And it was a very uncomfortable period. I'd look around me and see how other women had invented themselves into life there, and I didn't identify with them. And so I felt extremely frustrated because I felt like a moron, but I knew that I was really capable. And it was just a really sort of funny few years. But if I hadn't moved out to the country, I certainly wouldn't have taken what is now a much more creative path.
So if you look back to Annabel at 18, to Annabel at 38, what do you think was the big liberating moment that enabled you to think differently about the way you wanted to live your life?
So the big revelation for me was after the moving to the country, that slump that I went through, and I came out of it realizing that I can do whatever I want, and I'm in charge, and I have to decide what it is that I want, and I need to stop looking to other people or other structures or institutions to give that structure to me. So it was a very uncomfortable transition, but that's when things changed. I feel like I can do anything now, which I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I feel like I am the captain of my own ship.
The damage that negative self-talk about the shortcomings of our appearance and how we think we are perceived can wreak is something that needs to be talked about a bit more. It seems almost all women do it. I wanted you to hear Olivia because she quietly but emphatically reassures that despite the messages they are getting in the media that only youth matters, there are so many deeper levels of perception and beauty. She knows this because as a photographer, she's had a lot of time to observe women as subjects. And of course, in the end, everything comes back to confidence. Like Olivia, I believe we have to accept that this negative perception of our value is something that women have to unlearn and undo if they are to bolster their confidence. Mysteriously, it's a construct that men don't seem to have. But for us, it's a major inhibiting factor in moving ahead.
I've always photographed some of the most beautiful girls in the world. And after talking to them and talking to other girls at my workshop, I shake my head in disbelief that every woman has this. There is no one that goes without this pain of having to be judged by this all the time. And it doesn't matter at all, like the one we could point out, oh, but she's so gorgeous, but she's super self-confident about her arm or her nose, or like her hair isn't right, or there's all these details with women where they focus their energy on what's not good instead of focusing, okay, but I have really beautiful lips and I'm going to celebrate those lips, or I'm going to celebrate the hair, or I'm going to celebrate my movement, you know, that I can move like other people can't move, or that I can be totally comfortable in front of the camera, for example. That is divine. When you find that and you see someone that is so into their own skin that they can completely relax in front of you, that very, very rarely happens. It takes a day to work with someone before you can get into that space where they actually start to loosen up, and when they start to trust you. When they open that door, then it happens.
Ruth Ribicor is the warmest, most wonderful storyteller. And it's hard not to think there is just a little magic in evidence when you hear her story. And while not everyone can marry into a ribbon dynasty as she did, she's living proof that wonderful things can happen if you open your eyes to what's around you. After a dreadful diagnosis which saw her walk away from the job of her dreams, Ruth was completely reanimated when she discovered her husband's mother's family had been making ribbons, by hand, for 5 generations. Being Ruth, she went in deep and came out with an unquenchable thirst for knowledge about the antique textiles that make up France's vast cultural patrimony. That thirst, inevitably, if you know Ruth, went well beyond handmade ribbons. A community of artists and collaborators, now friends, soon set her on the path to something really wonderful. And yes, her body is probably holding her back. Ruth acknowledges her physical shortcomings and is pacing herself. She's starry-eyed, excited even about the prospects to come. Here's a quick take on what happened to Ruth and how she made her way back.
The truth of the matter, I mean, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the world. It's where people dream of living. But for me, to leave a career that I loved, I was the breadwinner at the time. So to leave the potential to contribute, the power to contribute in a marriage and in a family, to leave that in November to move to a tiny village where everything was shuttered up for 3 months. I didn't have a driving license. I had a 1-year-old. I left everything behind me. I was kind of buoyed up on this, the excitement of it all, and getting the house sorted and getting the utility bills in order and everything. But once all that initial excitement died away, I did find myself thinking, wow, that was it. That was it for me. That was all I had to contribute. I'm never going to get a job again. And so, yeah, it was really very terrifying. My confidence was shattered as a process of that. When we moved to France, I didn't have a cell phone for a year and a half. I just thought, well, nobody needs to get me except my mother-in-law, and my mother lives up the road. So, you know, I don't need to be contactable. I really went completely in the other direction. I just thought, that's it now. That was my moment. 8 years working for Walt Disney, and that was it. And I couldn't see how I could get another job, definitely not in the same industry, in this area, that if I wanted to work, I would have to create something for myself, because that was the only way.
If you had one piece of advice to give to others who find themselves in the abyss that you described, what would be the big thing that you would say to them? What's the one thing that you think was the most important catalyst for your recovery?
Well, I think leaving a work environment that I was in with Walt Disney, for example, where there is a system of merits, you get regular feedback and performance reviews. When you leave that system and nobody's kind of saying, oh, well done, you did a great job at being a mother, or, you know, oh, that dinner you made was phenomenal, I'm giving you a pay rise. I think I did feel I was entirely on my own. And so looking back I think without knowing what I was doing, I started to do lots of workshops, online, self-taught, little things that can boost your confidence and teach you that you're okay, that you're really capable. I think kind of building up your confidence again. And that was what worked for me. This idea that actually, you know what, I can do that. I'm really good at that. And I also think trusting yourself and just constantly being open to the idea of learning. Those are two elements that really worked for me. And I could never have imagined this adventure 10 years ago and everything that I've learned since and how all these kind of jigsaw puzzle pieces kind of fit into each other now. And at the time, they all seemed so disconnected, but they are now all coming together to fit into a bigger picture. I think if I was to rewind 10 years, I would tell myself to just not be so hard on myself, slow down and just trust and just never stop learning.
So the season is at an end, but I did want to tell you about an interview you can access if you're happy to go to unpaused.net and subscribe to our newsletter. There's an audio file waiting for you there as a gift from me to you. If you like Unpaused, I think you'll like this one too. Thanks to Skye, Fiona, Annabelle, Mark, Olivia and Ruth for saying yes and then giving so wholeheartedly of themselves and their stories. Thanks also to my absolutely indefatigable producer, Leonie Marsh, to my research assistant, Claudia Cameron, to Caroline Osborne for keeping the chaos at bay, and to Jason Milhouse and Lana Christensen for recording and editing support. I couldn't have done it without you. Together, I think we might be onto something. And thanks to you, the listener, and dare I say the subscriber, for convincing me that this is worthwhile. I've loved every minute of it, and I'll be back next year with more. Until next time, farewell.